point that the agreement on the nuclear issue is a higher priority for the Obama administration than fighting ISIS.
Is the United States and Iran becoming sort of unwilling partners in dealing with ISIS?
Well, there's definitely a concurrence or a convergence of interest between the United States and Iran in an objective sense. I mean, if you were, in a position to steer U.S. foreign policy in the direction of the objective interests of the United States on the ground in the Middle East, then that would certainly be one of the first things that you would want to do is to open up cooperation with Iran on this question of the ISIS problem.
That's Gareth Porter with Dennis Bernstein. I'll play the entirety of it tomorrow. It's available on SoundCloud. Just look for the Flashpoints channel on SoundCloud if you want to hear all of that. Sorry, I ran over here. I was engaged in a spirited discussion with Bill Gorell, who's hanging in today and for a couple of weeks on the show. Opinions are those of the speakers. Thanks for listening. And GEO's having a quaffing party tonight, fundraiser. So you'll hear more about that in the labor hour. They're going to drink.
Oh, okay.
And
why'd they say that?
I say that. I just wanted to elicit a response, and I did, from the studio audience here. Okay, I got to go. Thanks for listening. More from Gareth Porter. He's a graduate of the U of I, but not the J School, but doing some great work.
Yeah.
folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you in the air by listener-supported community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois, broadcasting at 90.1 FM in Central Illinois, and webcasting live worldwide at weft.org. So new views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Area Incorporated. Now here's Bill with some underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information, or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, call 217-328-2295. Say Jobs with Justice three times fast. The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. And the Graduate Employees Organization, also known as GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, strives not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice, both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio. And by the way, Labor Hour founder Peter Miller was also a founder of the GEO.
Yes. And speaking of GEO, they're having a craft beer and basically union-made craft beer and union-made wine fundraiser tonight at the Indigo Art Gallery at 9 East University in downtown Champaign. And that is right next to the brass rail between Neal and Walnut, directly just across the street from the Champaign City Building. And so it's all union-made craft beers as well as union-made wines. And again, this is sponsored by the GEO Graduate Employees Union. That's tonight at 7 p.m. at 9 East University, just south of the City Building, between Neal and Walnut Street in downtown Champaign. Okay, Bill, so what's new with you this week?
Well, there's the really big news this week is Kim Kardashian's butt.
Oh, please.
Yes, it's on the cover of a magazine called, I believe it's Paper, and it's obviously photoshopped. Otherwise, she has about a 12-inch waist and a 48-inch rump, which doesn't sound likely.
Okay.
But that's, you know, one of the things that I'm really getting sick of with the interwebs is this constant same advert for on all of these pages. You know, they can be, you know, alternate, you know, whatever, and there's still these ads there from this Taboola or whoever, and it's been about, you know, and there's always ads for Newsmax, even on the more liberal, progressive, and lefty commercial pages. I guess we'll have to start calling commercial pages now, as opposed to just nonprofit organizational pages. Mm-hmm. But you know, Newsmax is advertising on almost every page.
And what is anymore. Newsmax?
Newsmax is this insane, it's almost as bad as World Net Daily, World Net Daily, right-wing news website. And I, you know, that's just, you know, I mean, I don't know. It's really, this commercialization has just really gotten out of hand. And another weird thing too is like, I'll buy something, order something off the internet, you know, and then ads for it follow me around all the time for the thing that I just bought.
Yeah. Yeah. That's disgusting. Yeah. Well, there's some interesting news from somebody we know, Bill.
Oh, by the way, Volkswagen.
What about Volkswagen?
Volkswagen says, yes, we want this union here in Kentucky. To heck with you Republicans.
Oh, I saw something about that on Facebook. Yeah, I didn't get a chance to read the whole article.
Oh, yeah, they're definitely... what the deal is they're not making a deal with any one union.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And it's... any organization that represents at least 45% of the workforce will be at meetings with management, I believe, maybe once or at least twice a month or maybe more. Mm-hmm. And then an organization that only represents, say, 15%, mm-hmm. They get to meet fewer times,
okay,
less frequently.
Uh-huh.
So this sounds like an interesting situation developing there. Maybe somebody like the IWW could jump in and get 15% of the people or something.
Yeah.
And that reminds me, I believe that's the way it is in a lot of European countries.
Yes.
Like in France, it's like they have multiple unions in the same workplace,
yes,
for the,
yes,
same bargaining units.
Indeed, indeed. And you know what? Actually, I think this is a good thing in specifically in the fact that they haven't signed an exclusive contract with one union. Because frankly, this is going to make some of these unions out there to have to be a little more competitive in representing the members, because that's a big problem a lot of times when they sign us an exclusive sweetheart deal, and that's what it is more often than not, with a company, the members, the workers in those plants find that the union isn't really representing their interests more often than not, and instead is just concerned with the dues flow and more, and oftentimes representing management's issues as opposed to the workers. So I think this is a good development. And
yeah,
not to mention it's going to really piss off some of these right-wing politicians.
Oh yeah, I mean
that's definitely a nice little icing on the cake.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm just thinking of it like, you know, Germans, they seem to be, you know, so they got a little off the wall there back in the last century for a while.
No,
but
no, they didn't.
After that little incident,
a small clique took political power, okay, basically.
After that slight incident called World War II,
yeah,
you know, they've been, I think, one of the preeminently reasonable societies and cultures on, mm-hmm, the planet.
Yeah. You know, we could talk about that sometimes, about how Nazi Germany developed, because, you know, I think there's a lot of parallels to American society, you know. I mean, when it doesn't take, you know, a small determined group of people with enough, of course, political powerfully and financially powerful people behind them, I mean, can take power pretty easily. And then once they get in power, I mean, people, it's amazing how people will submit to their will so quickly and even go along with it, thinking it's a good thing.
I mean, there's a lot of
mass psychology issues here, you know?
Right, as long as it's not kind of impinging on your day-to-day life, more or less. You know,
well, even when it is, over time. I mean, you know how these things happen. They're incremental. It's not just suddenly, you know, once they get power, they start with something little, then they take a little more, and then a little
more.
Yeah,
but I mean, that can be done without, like, being sort of like super noticeable.
Yes.
That's the real brilliance of the American progressive movement, and probably how we have avoided such authoritarianism, is that you had people like Walter Lippmann, Edward Bernays, mm-hmm, and others who realized that the best thing to do was to manage people's thinking, mm-hmm, rather than
imposing it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Make them, you know, well, Aldous Huxley. Look at the difference between Brave New World and Orwell's 1984. Orwell's 1984 is the typical totalitarian style, whereas Huxley's people, they loved their lives,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
you know, until the Indians showed up and then kind of put the ratchet, you know. But that's, yeah, and that's just it. The people in the Soviet Union, they always knew they were being propagandized to.
Yeah.
The people in the United States, at least.
Most of them, I mean, not say most, but a huge percentage think this is the most freest and most accurate news media in the world. I mean, seriously, I've met workers who have said that, and I said, are you kidding me?
Oh, yeah. Well, most people I work with don't pay any attention to it.
Yeah.
You know,
that's better than, you know, thinking that everything you see on television is accurate, you know, and true, you know. Anyway, a mutual acquaintance of ours, Bill, James Kilgore, an African-American studies scholar and former, yes, member of the 1970s-era Symbionese Liberation Army group, could soon teach again at the University of Illinois. U of I trustees on Thursday were unable to reach a consensus on Kilgore's case, and Chancellor Phyllis Weiss said the campus would follow the recommendations of a campus committee that urged the U of I not to bar him from employment. Academic units will then be free to rehire him, possibly by January, if they are interested, Weiss said. After a four-hour executive session, the board issued a statement saying they engaged in a, quote, robust debate that represented a wide range of divergent viewpoints on Kilgore, a part-time adjunct employee at the U of I until last spring. While the board has clear statutory responsibility to act on tenure and tenure-track faculty and permanent staff hiring decisions, the board traditionally has not been involved in part-time and adjunct employee hiring decisions, the statement said. Instead, the board asked President Bob Easter to develop a, quote, clear policy, unquote, to guide future hiring decisions for part-time and adjunct staff and report back by January. So this is quite an interesting development. I mean, basically, James Kilgore, who's been on the Labor Hour several times talking about issues that are labor issues that are affecting South Africa, because he lived there for quite a few years, along with oftentimes he's come here with Professor Ken Salo, who's a native of South Africa originally. He was hired basically. He'd been working at the U of I and had great recommendations from his superiors, and had great feedback from his students. And then all of a sudden there was a 4-page article that appeared in the News Gazette.
Was it News Gazette? Are they the Human Resources Department of the University of Illinois now? Do you have to vet everybody through the News Gazoo?
Yeah, but because I'm saying this even though I have no hard smoking gun proof. But it appears that why the News Gazette all of a sudden decided to do a 4-page story about James Kilgore's past. I mean, something that happened 40 years ago. You know, he was involved when he was a very young man in his late teens, involved with back in the mid-70s, was involved with the Symrinese Liberation Army. You know, you got to understand what's going on back then. I mean, you had the FBI with COINTELPRO basically targeting civil rights and other activists, anti-war and activist groups like the Black Panthers, who were trying to make change for the better in this country, who were targeting for harassment, legal harassment, arrests, beatings, even murders.
Yes.
Even murders.
Fred Hampton.
Yes.
Right in this Chicago.
Yes. And frame-ups like they did with American Indian activists Leonard Peltier and so on and so forth. So you got to understand the times, I mean, back then. And James Kilgore got involved in this group, the Symrinese Liberation Army, as a way of basically fighting back against this system that we had in this country. I mean, we were almost at the verge of a civil war back
then. Well, I want to ask you something, too. Like, James Kilgore's family, are they any, like, isn't there a really presidential buddy named Bill Ayers, who's an influential education professor, who at one time said, we didn't blow up enough buildings?
Yeah.
A member of the Weathermen. I had a professor at Illinois State, an English teacher, who was a former weatherman. Mm-hmm. That was 25, I don't know how many years ago.
Yes. And the point is, this is something that happened to James
Kilgore. That's what I mean. I mean, he doesn't have the backup in society.
Yes.
Like indeed. Those people do.
Yeah, because those people had wealthy, connected parents,
Yeah.
And that's a very key issue, Bill. In general, this is basically the U of I fired James Kilgore after he'd been working there 2 years and doing very well because of this News Gazette article. And then this is based on something that he did 40 years ago. 40 years ago, okay? And that he basically went to jail for it. I mean, after he fled to South Africa for a few years, he was finally, I guess they had an arrest warrant out for him, and he came back and he served time for it. I mean, there was a bank robbery in which a bystander was...
Yeah, how much time did Bill Ayers do?
Indeed, yeah. And
his wife.
Yes. I mean, this bank robbery, an innocent bystander was killed, but James Kilgore didn't pull the trigger. He was just there. How many of us have ever been in a situation, especially when we're younger, when we've been with a group of associates or friends, and when one of them, being an idiot, did something that we didn't want them to do, and we ended up having to suffer the consequences for it.
Dave, I got I'm going to find the auxiliary cable at some point in this program, and
yes.
There's a really good commentary by Ohio... For just recently, Ohio anarchist governor candidate Sean Swain running for prison.
Running for prison?
Yeah, on the platform of giving the Ohio National Guard and all the police weapons back to the Indians and dissolving the government of Ohio. But he has a really good, he does a weekly essay, a radio essay, about 5 minutes. And he did a really good one on James Kilgore about a month or so.
Okay.
So I want to find that. We'll see if we can find the wire to plug the computer in.
Okay. Well, some other interesting news. I guess Missouri Governor Jay Nixon said that he will call. Oh, by the way, I just want to say James Kilgore will be coming on the Labor Hour here sometime next month in December to talk about more about his case. So stay tuned for that. Anyway, Missouri Governor Jay Nixon said that he'll call the Missouri National Guard should violence erupt after the grand jury decision in the case of Darren Wilson. During a press conference on Tuesday, Nixon also said that more than 1,000 law enforcement officials have completed 5,000 hours of specialized training over the past 2 months in preparation for the verdict, which will be announced any day now. In addition to the use of the National Guard, three police agencies, including St. Louis County Police, City Police, and Highway Patrol, will follow the same command if Darren Wilson is not indicted and protesters take the streets. Many departments have invested in new riot gear. Nixon also said that law enforcement officials have been in talks with churches, schools, and businesses to, quote, listen to people's concerns and develop strategies to specifically address them. These measures are not being taken because we believe violence will occur, but because we have a responsibility to plan for any contingency, Nixon said during a press conference on Tuesday. Violence will not be tolerated. Residents and businesses of this region will be protected. He also explained that he wants to maintain public safety while allowing people to speak peacefully. But members of the community are interpreting a different message. According to Michael Brown's cousin, Ty Pruitt, the police are getting ready for war when they should be getting ready for trial. That, to me, means that they've already made their decision. We still feel terrible. Right now, we feel about the same way as we felt when Michael Brown was lying dead in the middle of the street for 4.5 hours. Activist Ashley Yates of Millennium Activists United also expressed concern with Nixon and his plan. Quote, until the governor chooses to truly address the systemic issues that the murder of Michael Brown brought to the surface for many Americans, no press release or commission board will truly help this community move forward from this tragedy. Meanwhile, Michael Brown's parents, Michael Brown Sr. and Leslie McSpadden, spoke before the United Nations Committee Against Torture on Tuesday, calling for global intervention in America's policing tactics. The couple asked a panel to recommend that racial profiling and racially based police harassment across the jurisdiction surrounding the Ferguson stops, and for the Department of Justice to conduct a nationwide investigation of systemic police brutality and harassment in black and brown communities and youth in particular, adding that the methodology and findings of this investigation must be made publicly available. Whatever the grand jury decides in Missouri will not bring Michael back, Michael Brown Sr. said. We also understand that what you decide here may save lives. So that's going to be interesting. We'll see what happens here, Bill. But I can guarantee you that there's going to be a lot of people converging on Ferguson, Missouri, if they come back and find and don't indict Darren Wilson. In fact, it almost seems like they already know that he's going to be that he's not going to be indicted for the murder of Michael Brown.
Well, well, I was wondering what happened in the elections there. Did they have any local elections last Tuesday? And
I don't know. Anything? I did see something on Facebook that a group of African American members of the Ferguson community were basically forming their own Fannie Lou Hammer party.
Oh.
And run for local office because they said the local Democratic Party is just totally unconcerned with their issues and they're just not happy with how the local Democratic political party handled this whole thing with Michael Brown killing.
It wouldn't surprise me if the local Democratic Party, like out where I live in Piatt County, Illinois, would be somewhat of a moribund institution. In Piatt County last week, there was one Democrat. For all the positions that were open, sheriff, everything else, were uncontested. I mean, it was like the Soviet Union or something.
Yeah.
And a one-party county, there was one Democrat running for county board.
Mm-hmm.
Her name was Kathleen Pyatt.
Uh-huh. Like the county, okay.
Yeah, like she didn't have name recognition.
Yeah.
No, she couldn't win. It's like this friend of mine said, yeah, she's a Democrat and she's a woman.
Okay. Is it really that bad in Monticello?
Oh, it's well. I mean, this is Piatt County.
That's where most of the people live in the county.
Well, I don't know. B. Ment. I didn't happen to look for Monticello, but I was looking for my polling place the other day, and I came across a thing that told about voting in B-Met's like 65% Republican.
Okay.
And you mentioned the Barack Obama senatorial campaign.
Mm-hmm. Which one, U.S. or Illinois senatorial?
The U.S. senatorial campaign, where he was running against that nutball. The guy didn't even live in the state, and he's a complete nut.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, 45% of Piatt County voted for the complete nut.
Okay. This guy was, I believe he was some kind of millionaire, too.
Well, no, he's kind of a perennial, sort of a, one of the Ben Carson, Michael Steele, token Republican black guy. Now, you know, and he had run for president, and I can't remember his name at all, but he's just a real super nutty guy besides that.
Oh, you're not talking about Alan Keyes.
Alan Keyes.
That's right.
Yeah, didn't even live here.
Yeah.
You know, and but 45% of podcast. The only reason is because it had an R by his name. They probably didn't know who anybody was.
Yeah. Well, you know you what, know? Bill? There's a lot of people we know that do the same thing with a D next to their name, unfortunately, you know. Which is not also not working. So, but anyway, one last quick news story here. The North Idaho Central Labor Council, the AFL-CIO, has endorsed House Resolution 676, which is the single-payer Medicare for All bill in the U.S. House, reports President Brad Setterblum. We realize that the Affordable Care Act was a step in the right direction, but we believe that a single-payer system would be better for all of our members, he stated. The North Idaho Central Labor Council is located in Coeur d'Alene, region of North Idaho, rich in labor history since the 1890s, when miners waged militant struggles to defend their conditions.
That would be the Western Federation of Miners,
yes,
that presaged the IWW.
Yes, and to found their union, the Western Federation of Miners. And Setterblum, president of the North Idaho Central Labor Council in 2009, was instrumental in bringing House Resolution 676, Single Payer for All, Medicare for All, before the Idaho AFL-CIO Convention in June of 2013, when Idaho became the 43rd state AFL-CIO Federation endorsed the bill. Setterblum is from Ironworkers Local 14, where he was held 14 elected positions, including vice president, and the North Idaho Central Labor Council is the 148th Central Labor Council to endorse House Resolution H.R. 676, Single-Payer Medicare for All, Expanded and Improved Medicare. So very interesting development there. There's an organization that's really starting to kick it off here called Labor for Single-Payer. It's a nationwide organization, and you're going to be hearing more about them on upcoming segments of the Labor Hour. Okay, we're going to take a quick music break here, and I want to play this song from Tom Morello in honor of Veterans and Labor Day. And it's called Battle Hymn.
Battle hymns for the broken, battle hymns for the misled, battle hymns for the wretched, the forgotten and the dead, battle hymns of redemption, of solidarity and pride, battle hymns we will be singing at the turning of the tide. The mothers and the fathers of those who come riding home in coffins in their military clothes, shiny medals pinned to their dead teenage chests while the trumpets blare, and you lie your best, so ask all you want from the dusk till the dawn, the answer's still no. Battle hymns for the broken, battle hymns for the misled, battle hymns for the wretched, the forgotten and the dead, battle hymns of redemption, of solidarity and pride, battle hymns we will be singing at the turning of the tide. Explain away the sleight of hand and the criminality of spending souls for oil. Well, in the mirror I can see I am the path that leads down. I am the dark and bloody hall I'm the reaper, executioner, hangman, judge, and the law. So tie a yellow ribbon round the oak tree on the lawn. But the cavalry's not coming, 'cause brother, they're gone. Battle hymns for the broken, battle hymns for the misled, battle hymns for the wretched, the forgotten and the dead. Battle hymns of redemption, of solidarity and pride. Battle hymns we will be singing at the turning of the tide. So I'm sharpening my shovel, I'm firing the kiln. I'm blind and I am purposeful, a martyr on the hill. The dream you might be dreaming might be someone else's dream tonight. I'm the whisper of misgivings, I'm the fading tail light. I'm the call for retribution from the back of the smoke-filled hall. I'm the vow of bitterness, I'm the poison in the well. I've a photographic memory of the deeds I will avenge. I'm the cold in the river hollow. I've a hatpin, I've a plan, and I don't care of cause or consequence. Head shaved and body lean, I'm the go-getter, the score settler. I'm the shadow on the green. And there's a flock of blackbirds flying nearly 10,000 strong, who set off this morning. Battle hymns for the misled, battle hymns for the wretched, the forgotten, for the dead. Battle hymns of redemption, of solidarity and pride. Battle hymns we will be singing at the turning of the tide.
Okay, that was Tom Morello singing the song Battle Hymns. I thought we'd play that in honor of veterans and Veterans Day. Tom Morello, you know, he's got some other songs too, relate to veterans and everything. But anyway,
well, I would also point people to Steve Earle.
Steve Earle,
yes. His later work during the time of the war, and also Merle Haggard.
Oh, some yes, indeed.
That one album. I'll go out and get those later, maybe. And anyway, at the Art Theater in downtown Champaign, continuing daily for a second week, is Birdman, starring Michael Keaton in a stellar performance. Also playing is one of my all-time favorites. This is Spinal Tap.
Okay.
And that will be playing tonight and Wednesday the 19th. On Monday night, the 17th, there will be a special showing of Stanley Kubrick's award-winning movie Paths of Glory with Kirk Douglas, considered one of the greatest anti-war movies ever made. The daily schedule for these movies can be found online at the Art Theater's website, arttheater.coop.
Okay.
Oh, wait, one more, Dave.
Okay.
And Meatheads is giving back 10% to you. And this is today. When you eat at Meatheads today, Meatheads will donate 10% of the net sales back to WEFT.
Wow.
Let me see. And Meatheads is at 1305 South Neal Street.
Mm-hmm.
It's not hard to find. You can see it right off the road. I've eaten there.
Is it?
It's pretty good stuff.
Okay.
And so that's there, those two announcements.
Okay. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area and have an extra coat to spare, please bring it over to the School for Design and Society this Sunday, tomorrow, November 17th, between 2 and 3 p.m. This winter is supposed to be extra cold, and we're working with other local groups to give coats to people who need them. Come drop off a coat, and if you have a moment, drink some cider and have cookies with us. We're at 122 Franklin Street in Urbana, Illinois, and that's just a one-block-long street right next to Crystal Lake Park in Urbana off of Broadway. And tune in today from 2 to 3 p.m. For another sports show with fellow worker Neil Parthen. That's WRFU 104.5 FM, and that's another sports show. And tune in tomorrow from 3 to 4 on Urbana Public Television Comcast Channel 6 for 9/11 TV. Tomorrow on Sunday after that from 4 to 5 is Labor's Worldview TV. And those are at on Urbana Public Public Television, Comcast Channel 6, and also you can stream it live at www.urbanapublictelevision.org. And just another reminder of the Craft Beer Union Made Wine and Beer Fundraiser tonight at Indigo at 9 East University in downtown Champaign between Neil and Walnut, and it's all made Union Made craft beers as well as Union Made wine, sponsored by the Graduate Employees Union, tonight at 7 p.m. 9 East University, just across the street from the Champaign City Building between Neil and Walnut. So turn out for that. It's going to be a good one.
All right. Now.
So, anyway, we're going to take one more quick music break with Utah Phillips, and we will be right back with some very interesting Bill Gorell wants to share with us. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio station, WFT in Champaign, Illinois. We'll be right back.
I was traveling through Illinois when I was invited to stop and sing at a memorial there in the little town of Mount Olive. Now, who of note in American history is buried in the cemetery in Mount Olive, Illinois? I'll give you a hint. It was a woman. It was the Union Miners Cemetery. Do you have it yet? Mary Harris. Mary Harris Jones. Mother Jones. It's hard for the mind to encompass a life that embraced the presidencies between Andrew Jackson and Herbert Hoover. Why, when Mother Jones was a little girl, there were people still alive who remembered the Revolutionary War. And she died on the eve of the New Deal. Her millinery shop burned down in the Chicago fire, and she had heard Abraham Lincoln speak in person. Mostly, though, Mother Jones was the miner's friend. Down in Kentucky, Tennessee, West Virginia. Well, the men would be organizing the underground workers, the miners. Mother Jones had already organized their wives and led them over the snow-covered game trails down into the Hollis, where, armed with mops and brooms, they drove the scabs out of the coal pits. Now, Mother Jones wasn't an organizer, she was an agitator, which meant often enough she was hated as much by the organizers as by the bosses. One time, Mother Jones was out in Colorado at the great Ludlow strike. Now, that was a strike to enforce the 8-hour day, which the state of Colorado had made a law, but they couldn't enforce it because Rockefeller owned the militia. Now, the governor promised not to send the militia into the coal fields, but he lied, and he did. Mother Jones was in the union hall down there at Ludlow, and word came that the militia had entered the coal fields. Well, she leapt up, and she screamed, "Let's go get the sons of bitches!" And she stormed out. She didn't look to see if anybody was following her. Nobody was following her. She just flounced up the road alone and confronted the militia. And that was the year that President Theodore Roosevelt called Mother Jones the most dangerous woman in America. And she was 83 years old. That's some kind of dangerous.
Okay, that was Utah Phillips and Annie DeFranco singing The Most Dangerous Woman, a song about Mother Jones, who's buried down in Mount Olive, Illinois, between Springfield and East St. Louis. So, Bill, what is it you want to share with the listeners here?
Okay, this is from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain. And I can't remember the details right now, but he's in prison for, I believe, killing somebody in self-defense. I guess he didn't get to stand his ground. In Ohio. And he, anyway, what this is, it's a, commentary he did about James Kilgore.
Oh, wow. Okay.
This guy we were talking about, Symbionese Liberation Army veteran.
Yeah.
Veteran, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
And erstwhile, but maybe soon to be back, University of Illinois teacher. Probably very underpaid. You said he was an adjunct, right?
Yes.
Sir. Oh, man, adjunct. Yeah. But anyway, paid by, that's piecework.
Yes, indeed.
Academic piecework.
There's
man.
A great film that I saw that was about the adjunct professors, which I are academic professionals, professors, that was done by Joe Barry. He had a labor history film class. And, you know, the intro of the film showed the, you know, sort of the transposed the 1960s documentary, Bitter Harvest, I think it was called, which Edwin R. Murrow actually.
It was a Harvest of Shame.
Harvest of Shame, yes. Yeah. Thank you, Bill. And it's amazing what similarities adjuncts have to these, you know, migrant workers, you know, that harvest fruits and vegetables. I mean, it's incredible.
Well, I mean, I imagine there is some migratory work involved in this. You know? You got to go where the work is, too.
There's one man they talked to who was an adjunct. He was in the early 60s, and he'd been an he had his PhD for 40 years. And almost 40 years, and he still had never been hired by a university as far as a full-time professor or instructor of any kind. You know, so therefore, he had no health benefits, no retirement to speak of, and he had to go to four different colleges in the Los Angeles area in order to make a living. I mean, crazy.
Yeah. Well, okay, Dave, you about got the auxiliary thing queued up there.
Okay. Yes, I do.
Press her up. I'll just click. We'll see what happens.
Have you heard about the case of adjunct professor James Kilgore at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign? Kilgore is an interesting guy. In the early 1970s, he was a member of the Symbionese Liberation Army, which makes him a personal hero of mine. The SLA was an urban guerrilla faction, robbed banks, kidnapped Patty Hearst, and, along with the Weather Underground, effectively brought an end to the Vietnam War. As one demand for the release of Patty Hearst, the SLA had Hearst's father, the publishing magnate, deliver millions of dollars in free food to the inner-city poor of Oakland. There's a PBS documentary called Guerrilla about the SLA. It's inspiring. Starting in 1975, Kilgore went underground and lived overseas until 2002. He then came back to the U.S. and pled guilty to possession of explosives, a charge from 1975, and to passport fraud. He served 6 years in prison, and since 2010, Kilgore has been on the faculty of the University of Illinois in Urbana, teaching classes on urban planning and on global studies. After Kilgore effectively organized his community against the building of a new jail in town, a local rag called the News Gazette went on a smear campaign against Kilgore. The paper published a few pieces on him that completely reinvented the facts of Kilgore's SLA involvement. They completely sensationalized the story, with the clear goal of getting Kilgore ousted from his job. Keep in mind, when the University of Illinois hired Kilgore, they knew about his past. He didn't lie about it or try to conceal it. He came into the job interview as a former urban guerrilla with a felony conviction and was still the best teacher for the job. But under pressure from right-wing headhunters at the local poison pen, Kilgore was fired. Since then, a petition has circulated and gained the needed 1,000 signatures in support of James Kilgore. He's gained statements of support from Associate Provost Robin Kaler and from American Association of University Professors. There's also been a groundswell of support from prisoner rights groups who see the implications of this case for the employment of convicted felons everywhere, 15 million Americans. Personally, I take a different view. I don't believe James Kilgore should fight to make the University of Illinois rehire him. To me, that's pointless. The spineless, hapless university administrators have already proven that they're slaves to perceived public opinion when they fired Kilgore. Well, let him go. Under the pressure from the News Gazette. So if Kilgore gets rehired under public pressure, he has to worry for the rest of his life about idiots who managed to mount a counter-campaign of successful pressure again. Kilgore could be hired and fired a dozen times before he retires. Who needs that kind of stress? I think that rather than going back to the university on bended knee with his husband's hands, Kilgore should do what he does best. He can organize dozens of former students with whom he developed his best rapport and recruit them for a new project. If the powers that be want to foreclose on Kilgore's efforts to put down the assault rifle and turn over a new leaf and make a new start, perhaps he should pick up the assault rifle at lock and load. He could easily reconstitute the Symbionese Liberation Army, teach former students the strategies and tactics of guerrilla warfare, and start the next campaign with an assault on the Nuclear Diet. Then he could storm the University of Illinois in Urbana, planning a ski house, the staccato rhythms of a machine gun to punctuate his arrival. My thinking is, if the gatekeepers of modern culture want to pee on someone trying to go along with the program, they should perhaps have enough sense not to pee on the guy who can assemble an AK-47 in 30 seconds and shoot your face off. Forcing them to deal with a newly constituted urban guerrilla faction, the second incarnation of the Symbionese Liberation Army, would be an excellent way for adjunct professor James Kilgore to teach a valuable lesson. If the system won't accept your peaceful, well-intended participation, use that explosive experience from 1975 and leave a smoking crater where the haters used to be. Shoot first, ask for a job later. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Ohio Supermax Facility. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
Yeah. By the way, folks, keep in mind he is calling from a prison, so that's sometimes the sound doesn't get that good.
Wow, what an interesting perspective.
Well, what was it John Kennedy said? If we people can't get their way peacefully, then they will.
Well,
that's a big quote.
Yeah. Basically that those who make peaceful evolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable. Yeah.
Yeah.
But wow, that's interesting. I can't totally agree with it, but, you know, he does make some interesting points. That's really interesting. Does he do a regular, podcast or whatever from prison?
Yeah, this is weekly, and it's featured on The Final Straw, which is an anarchist radio program. I believe it's out of Asheville, North Carolina.
Okay.
And they play it every week, and it's also posted individually, too. And you can get these things from one of my all-time favorite websites. Mm-hmm. I've abused it for, over a decade now, and that is radioforall.net. Mm-hmm. That's radio, numeral 4ALL.net.
Yes, and in fact, that's where our Labor Hour, World Labor Hour archive is. And if you want to
read,
not all of our shows, but a lot of them are archived there.
Yeah, Dave, and I'm just, talk to the listeners here about this. You know, I don't listen to WEFT that much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's a show running I want to listen to, I don't listen to all the, there's other things I listen to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't like all the music on WEFT, that's for sure. And I kind of have my radio station that I make from radioforall.net mainly, and sometimes go into some other places if they run out there. Some regular things. There's a couple of interesting shows by a sort of English almost conspiratorialist, Tony Gosling from Bristol Broadband Radio. And there's the Radio for All itself is an outgrowth of that old A Anarchos listserv.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all kinds of, there's even this one kind of crank that's gone by the name Visigoth at certain times. He's calling himself A.L. Eric right now, who's sort of has this strange conspiracy. Actually, a lot of this history that's hidden.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy is so off of it. He calls people patriotards and people who think about the Constitution paper worshiper, parchment worshipers.
Hmm.
And he's really for the Articles of Confederation.
Okay.
You know, but I mean, just all over the place.
Yeah, you know,
mainly progressive left wing stuff.
That's another show we should have sometime, basically talking about the difference between the Articles of Confederation, which preceded the Constitution, which basically got eliminated because of the wealthy, planter class that were the founding fathers, at least the more elitist segments of the founding fathers.
Yeah. And some other, Building Bridges is on there, WBAI's long-term labor show.
Okay.
Building
Bridges is a labor show?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was just mainly general public affairs.
Oh, no, it's a labor show. I actually, there was an interim there, you know, after Peter left and so on and so forth. And I used to play a lot of their episodes in the second half of this program years ago.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, though, that WFT is a real gem of a community, you know, resource in the sense that, like you said, Bill, you don't necessarily like all the music on WFT or all the public affairs programs, but the fact that we got such a variety out there that everybody's bound to find something that they like. And you know, most of the stuff, both the public affairs programs and the various musical genres, you're not going to hear on corporate radio. No way. Are you thinking corporate radio station would play this segment that Bill just played, this Anarchist in Prison? I mean, you know, we don't necessarily agree with a lot of the things we air here, but you know,
I do not advocate that James Kilgore bring back the Symbionese Liberation Army and shoot people.
Yeah, I agree too.
I don't yeah, agree with that, but things. I thought it was an interesting perspective to bring to you you would not hear elsewhere.
That's it.
And by the way, a lot of our public affairs programming is coming from RadioForAll.net right now. A lot of the stuff during the week that took the place of the regular news show after it died are from RadioForAll.net. They're really good shows. There's things like Time of Useful Consciousness. I can't even think of them all. And a lot of them are, you know, kind of local in themselves, too.
Okay. And we're going to play another quick track here from Utah Phillips Nate DeFranco called Why Come. And we're going to be right back. And I want to talk a little bit more with Bill here on some of his perspectives on the recent election. So stay tuned. You listen to the World Labor Hour here on WEFT, Listener Support Community Radio Station in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned.
Jack Miller kept the Senior Citizen Center for a long time up there in Seattle, Washington. Jack had spent most of his life in the forest as a logger or timber beast, they called him in those days, because you were treated like an animal. There were no bunkhouses. He recalled sleeping on the ground with his fellow workers with their wet clothes from the rainforest piled in a heap next to the fire, hoping that they would be dry by the time to go to work the next day. Spoke many different languages in the forest, and they could hardly talk to each other. It was just like Lawrence. He said most of them had never been to school. Most of them couldn't read or write. Jack Miller could remember the Verona. There was a shingle weaver strike up at Everett, Washington, called the Everett Massacre. It's another one of those that didn't make it into the history books. The Wobblies, they chartered a steam launch called the Verona. And they had it sailed up there to Everett, bringing strike relief. And as the boat sailed into the pier, Sheriff McRae had ringed the whole pier with armed deputies. He just deputized every drunk in every bar in town and put a rifle in their hand. Well, they surrounded the boat. And when they lowered the gangplank, Sheriff McRae walked to the end of it and said, "Who are your leaders here?" And they shouted back with one voice, "We are all leaders here." Well, that scared the tar out of the law, you know. And they began shooting. Those deputies began shooting. A lot of those Wobblies were killed. Some of the deputies were killed in the crossfire, though. So when the Wobblies and those that survived made it back to Seattle, they were arrested. And they were thrown in the Snohomish County Jail on a charge of murder. A whole bunch of them. Well, that jail was an all-steel jail. It was the newest affair, all made out of steel. It had just barely opened, so the heat wasn't on, and there was no blankets, and you couldn't get any smokes. So those Wobblies, they passed a note from one cell block to the other. And then by common consent, the next day, they were all gathered in the middle of each cell block. And when the noon whistle blew, they began to jump up and down simultaneously. Up and down, singing all the time. And finally they hit the resonating frequency of that jail and cracked the south wall. They broke the jail.
That's right. See what the power of workers organized can do. Utah Phillips, Danny DeFranco, song Why Come. So anyway, Bill, you know, I know last week you didn't make the show until the very, very end, and we had Ann Feeney on, but we just touched on this subject, and I'd like to get your take on it. It was the elections that happened a week and a half ago, both local and national.
Well, you know, I was complaining about having Pike County on the local level. We don't have anybody to vote for. But apparently on the pretty much the other levels, you don't have anybody to vote for because Democrats were just really, you know, they run away from themselves all the time, you know. Now, we have a state here, and I think you guys probably brought this up last week, and there were several referenda. At least a couple of them were non-binding. And all of them would have come out of the 1970s Democratic platform. I don't know about legalizing pot, but very progressive referenda all passed. But we end up with a Republican governor. But on the other hand, what difference does it make? Because Democrats in this state, they can't get together to get anything done anyway.
Well, and also. It just seems like the Democratic Party, I mean, not all Democratic elected officials, but unfortunately more and more and more since the mid-90s when Bill Clinton was in, have basically become more and more like Republicans every year. And it's like they've been, you know, they talk a good talk, but then once it seems like a lot of them get in power, just like our former governor, Pat Quinn, you know, get in there and they start doing things just like the Republicans would do. In the case of Quinn going after state workers' pensions, you know, I mean, this is totally unacceptable.
Yeah, why didn't anybody ever have the idea of perhaps appealing to Washington for help? How about a little quantitative easing, not just of government bonds, but how about some quantitative easing for these pension plans that these states, you know, are saddled with, and which both parties' hands are generally equally dirty in allowing them to become bankrupt as they are by kicking cans down the road, not paying for things when they should have been paid up. Illinois is terrible for that.
Yes.
For example, now they don't raise the license plate rate, you know, a couple of bucks a year. They let it sit for 25 years and they raise it like, you know, 50 bucks.
Yeah, we don't have a budget crisis in Illinois. We have a revenue crisis. That's the problem in a nutshell.
Okay, well, that's one of the things that people in Illinois voted for was a special tax on millionaires.
Yes.
To fund schools. Yes. Does that sound like a Republican proposal to youths?
No. See, that's the thing here, Bill, is that, you know, in this last election in which we lost a Democratic governor in Illinois and gained a Republican right-wing governor, and then on the national level, where the Republicans now have control of not just the House but also the Senate, is that it wasn't like working people all of a sudden quit voting Democrat and voted Republicans. It's that they stayed home because so many of these Democratic candidates were no better than the Republicans they were running against in a lot of cases. The lowest voter turnout in recorded history happened this last week and a half. I mean, 36%, only about one in three eligible voters turned out to vote because the Democrats have no principles for the most part. They have nothing they stand on. They have none of the issues that would appeal to working people and get their support because they're beholden to corporate money. Now, there are a few exceptions, of course, but the fact is that all these great voter referendums that passed, not just in Illinois, but all over the country for the minimum wage to be increased, to for legalization of marijuana. I mean, and there's all sorts of other great ballot initiatives out there that passed overwhelmingly at the same time that the Republicans took back the Senate. I mean, some people might see this